The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher, go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Richard Madeley reads his diary for the week. Cindy Yu explores the power of nostalgia, which appears to be a thriving industry in China. Lara Prendergast declares that bankers are hot again. Reviewing Sally Coulthard's book, The Apple, A Delicious History, Penn Vogler ponders how the simple fruit became core to our history. And James Dellingpole declares that Joe Rogan is as edgy as Banksy. Take that how you will. Up first, Richard Madeley.
Would-be Veep Tim Walz has opened Pandora's box with his use of the W word to characterise Donald Trump and his running mate. No sniggering at the back there. This W is for weird. Because let's face it, a heck of a lot of politicians are way out weird, aren't they? It's practically part of the job description. If we start calling them all out on it, the currency is going to devalue fast. My thesaurus devotes nearly half a page to synonyms for weird. Freaky, wacko, odd, eccentric, crazy, off the wall, out to lunch. Well, sure, that is pretty much Trump to a T. I mean, he is uniquely odd. But those adjectives neatly summarise plenty of politicos this side of the pond as well. Liz Truss. Oh, come on, don't get all Truss defensive. You know she was weird. Theresa May. May closed the lid of the weird box firmly over her own head when she said the naughtiest thing that she'd ever done was to run through fields of wheat. I mean, that is a really weird thing to say. And as for her excruciating conference Maybot dance, well, I rest my case. It's funny, but all the party leaders that I can think of that I would describe as weird seem to have been kind of on the right. Corbyn wasn't weird, he was cracked. Kinnock was delusional. Callaghan was bank manager boring. Wilson was dull as ditchwater too. Well, apart from his private life, not so much weird as way hey. But spinning back to a further on the right, Ted Heath was proper weird. I mean, that laugh. Head and shoulders pumping up and down like a supercharged nodding donkey. And as for his private life, well, what private life? Did Bachelor Ted even have one? Apart from his passion for classical music and sailing, it's a blank canvas, even today. Again, weird. But as I said, anyone who chooses a life in politics is fundamentally weird, not on planet normal. So now that Donald has belatedly agreed to a TV debate with Kamala, if she throws the whole weird thing at him, well, then there's really only one riposte. And your point being? But of course, Windy Donald will go off on a tangled tangent. Maybe he'll reprise his baffling late great Hannibal Lecter line. Why would he do that? Because he's weird. I may not know much about art, but I know what I hate. That's Monty Burns from The Simpsons. I kind of feel the same way about the Olympics. All right, maybe hate is a bit strong, but I was bemused by some recently included categories. Breakdancing. Seriously? I thought allowing skateboarding into the Olympics was bizarre enough. I mean, is it a sport? Is it athletics? Skateboarding is basically mucking around on a supersized roller skate. But breakdancing? The founding fathers of the Olympics must be spinning in their Greek graves. Presumably not on their heads, though. Some of the more liberal-minded insist that there's no proof that the swift, stiff sentences dished out to rioters has had a deterrent effect. Well, I'd say it's pretty much a textbook example of cause and effect. You only have to look at the reaction of convicted rioters when they were told that they wouldn't be coming home for Christmas. Many burst into tears. One 30-something rock tosser sobbed for his mum. I'd bet the cost of the entire clean-up operation that none of these guys will venture near a riot again. And many of those planning to cause mayhem last weekend will have had a somewhat abrupt change of mind. Sorry to sound like an old-fashioned reactionary, but it's undeniable that exemplary sentencing deters reoffending and others contemplating similar crimes in a way that soft punishment simply doesn't. I used to be a court reporter back when suspended sentences were much less common, but I do vividly recall the reactions of those handed one. Yeah, there was relief, there was even gratitude now and then, but most miscreants would smirk or punch the air, expression and body language unmistakable. Yeah, got away with it. Until last week, We seem to have all but forgotten the crucial component of deterrence in sentencing. Sadly, I'm sure that our reawakening will be a brief one. Of all sports, boxing has the greatest disparity between males and females. Boxers with the XY chromosome punch, on average, 162% harder than those with the XX. So you don't put them in the ring together, any more than you'd match a heavyweight with a welterweight. Unless, of course, you're the International Olympic Committee. I'm with Sharon Davis on this one. She says the insane gender row which engulfed Olympic boxing amounts to genuine neglect by the IOC, and that we're on the cusp of a female athlete being killed. I think she's right. You don't define gender by what's on somebody's passport. You check their chromosomes. XX marks the spot. XY marks the other one. It's that simple.
That was Richard Madeley. Now, Cindy Yu.
Nostalgia is a thriving industry in China. I first noticed this while walking around Nanjing last summer. There were shops with names like Finding Childhood or Childhood Memories, selling sweets and toys that had long been discontinued. There were posters of TV shows and celebrities from the 1980s and 1990s. The customers were like me, misty-eyed millennials, often women, looking for their lost childhoods. Oh my God, do you remember that? We relished every moment. The shops have sprung up suddenly in the past 2 years, mostly catering to my generation, who spend more on high street tat than our elders. But older Chinese have been seeking nostalgia too. They get their hit from remembering a more rural way of life. Villages on the edges of cities have been renovated for the urban day tripper and designed to feel tranquil, agrarian, evocative of a China before Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms. Wealthier urbanites buy up rural cottages there for second homes, as if they can buy back their own pasts. Social media has no end of trad content. There's a huge market for rural influencers who grow their own food and cook from scratch on wood-fired stoves. Some are young people who say they've become burnt out by city life. Last year's hottest TV show, Blossom Shanghai, is set in the 1990s and shot mostly in sepia tones. There's nothing uniquely Chinese about yearning for the past. Populists everywhere have found nostalgia a helpful emotion. Vote Leave had Take Back Control. Donald Trump had Make America Great Again. But whereas Western countries might lament their relative fall in power or economic dynamism, the same can't be said for China. If anything, China's good old days are now. The country is more powerful than it has been in centuries. Living standards, life expectancy, education rates are higher than any time in history. So what's there to be nostalgic about? How can today's Chinese be nostalgic about a poorer, harsher time? The obvious answer is that most people are nostalgic about their past. Those with happy childhoods look back on a less stressful, more innocent age. But even those who had a more gruelling time may have had bright spots of happiness they recall fondly. When my mother thinks of the 1970s, it's not the Cultural Revolution she remembers, nor the fact that her siblings had been sent to different relatives when her parents were imprisoned. Instead, she remembers how happy she was foraging for wild veg with her sister and climbing trees with the local boys. She reminisces about the simpler times. Chinese nostalgia, I think, exerts such a pull because the past people yearn for has disappeared so quickly. The economy is 120 times bigger than in 1978, the year Deng's reforms began. There are hundreds more cities now and hundreds of millions more people living in them. Cities like Shenzhen, the 13 million strong metropolis built on the site of a town of 300,000, bulldozed in the 1980s. It's hard to find a street anywhere that looks the same as it did 50 years ago. A few years ago, my family revisited my grandparents' first home, on a state-owned farm where they worked in a commune and where my mother and her siblings grew up. That way of life is gone now, as is their house and the farm, all derelict. My grandmother's contemporaries had, like her, moved into city apartments and spent their days looking after grandchildren. The fields and tree-lined dirt road to the nearest town had been dug up. But the new homes that were meant to be built there hadn't yet been started. It had been like that for a while, we were told. The changes are more than just material. In the words of one Chinese blogger, as the economy got better, the affection between people has gone. The migration to anonymous megacities cut community ties and boosted crime. You can no longer rely on a neighbour for last-minute childcare or leave your door unlocked. With increased wealth came more corruption and inequality. Neighbours became envious of each other and competed. Success in school, work, or even marriage could be life-changing not only for yourself, but for your children. At least when people were poor, we were all poor together. a Chinese businessman once told me. Some lament the spiritual hollowness of modern life. Communism offers something to believe in, as religion had done before that. Without either, people feel empty. So some Chinese speak about a crisis of meaning, a vacuum left by the death of ideology. It may be why the incredible economic boom of the 1990s coincided with a national revival of Tai Chi, the semi-religious meditation practice. So what do the nostalgic Chinese do when they can't find a trace of their childhood homes or the streets they grew up on? They seek out shops peddling memories. They escape to the countryside. They listen to retro music from Taiwan and Hong Kong, the stuff that was popular before music from the mainland caught up. Some even travel to North Korea, which was booming as a tourist destination until the pandemic hit, with 120,000 Chinese visiting in 2019. On return, they write online that it's just like China in the 1970s. They mean it as a compliment. But like scratching an itch, the indulgence is unsatisfactory. Spend too long in the childhood shops and you'll notice the goods are overpriced and tacky. The supposedly tranquil countryside spots are Potemkin villages with shiny visitor centres, car parks big enough to cater for twice a village's population, and trendy coffee shops that certainly weren't there in the 1970s. And behind every rural influencer, there's almost certainly a small gaggle of city-based crew armed with professional lighting and kit.
That was Cindy Yu. Now, Lara Prendergast.
I'm looking for a man in finance with trust fund. 6'5", blue eyes, finance, trust fund.
When Megan Boney posted this ditty on her TikTok account a few months ago, it was meant as a joke. She wanted to poke fun at the wish list mentality of single women, herself included. She couldn't have predicted that her 19-second video would be viewed 26 million times and remixed into one of the summer's viral hits. Women are now whispering to each other that maybe they really are looking for a man in finance rather than an impoverished creative type still living with his parents at the age of 30. Boney has since reiterated that she's not actually looking for a man in finance, and perhaps she needn't bother, given that she's landed herself a record deal. But the damage is done. Men in finance are hot again, says Vogue. We all deserve a second chance. Even bankers in their branded gilets. It will pain earnest millennials to hear this. Many of us came of age in the wake of the 2008 crash, when it was drummed into us that feckless city boys were to blame for the financial instability. We would hold ourselves to a higher standard, naively following our dreams and prioritising a career that would add meaning, if not necessarily riches, to our lives. The kids now think that's daft. And they may well have a point. It probably is a lot easier to chase your dreams when you're not worried about rent. Who hasn't read a millennial think piece about how hard life is and thought, well, you made your bed? For an accurate portrait of the modern finance bro, look to Industry, the hit HBO show. The third season began airing this week in the US and will soon return to the BBC. It gives us a glimpse into London's gritty world of high finance, or what the New Yorker termed Thatcherite brutality. The overarching message is that no matter where you hail from, if you hustle enough, you might make it big. Or die trying. Or at the very least, shag the posh girl. No wonder young chancers love what the show represents. The city is a place where a combination of skill and cunning can catapult you to the top. This is the closest thing to a meritocracy there is, explains Harper, the 20-something lead character when we first meet her, and I only ever want to be judged on the strength of my abilities. Never mind that we later discover she has lied on her CV to get a foot in the door and that she's a bit of a crook. Hers was a very Gen Z mindset. The show was written by my friends Mickey Down and Conrad Kay, both of whom worked in banking before deciding to take their chances writing a TV drama about their experience. The luster really came off finance post-2008, Con tells me. Millennials felt ashamed about making money the focus of their career, while Gen Z, mostly thanks to smartphones, can monetize their identity. They get paid for being in the world and telling people how they live. There is no shame in flaunting your status and wealth. People don't just walk into highly paid city jobs. It takes some planning if you want to end up gravitating around the gherkin. This might explain why subjects such as maths and further maths are growing in popularity, with a record number of students taking A-level maths this year. Sure, governments will try to take credit for the shift away from more artistic subjects, but I'd be willing to bet a more compelling case for doing maths is that it might mean you earn loads of cash later down the line and get a girlfriend, even if you aren't 6'5". In the US, banking is now the top industry college graduates want to go into, up from fifth place in 2021. I WhatsApp a 20-something friend who skipped university but managed to wrangle a swinging dip job in London. He has kept his eyes on the prize, money, and marches off each day in a smart blue suit. I think you can tell he doesn't have a student loan to worry about. Does he agree that his generation has different priorities to mine? Lara, my friends and I are all openly obsessed with making money and changing our lives, he says. We don't care about doing noble professions like you do. I send a laughing, crying face emoji back, which I know dates me. He gives me a list of the groups and people he follows online for financial advice and tips. The groups are all called things like Money Hustle, Get Rich, and Entrepreneurs Being Entrepreneurs. One guy named Miles, or M.Iles, is 25 and has almost 500,000 followers. His Instagram bio says that he is probably wearing a @signet quarter zip, and indeed he does seem to be in almost every photo, aside from when he is dressed in black tie or has his top off. He has blue eyes. It's tricky to tell if Miles' account is a parody or not. There are photos of him cosplaying as Patrick Bateman. Either way, Miles is living the industry life. He's in a helicopter looking after the Shard, then he's off skiing with a bikini-clad ski bunny, popping bottles of champagne before it's on to a country wedding in a sports car, then back to Threadneedle Street, and presumably the job that pays for all of this. I can see why young men might want to be Miles. I can also see why Miles might not be a bad investment opportunity for women with certain aspirations. What's better than selling out? Letting your partner sell out so you can afford to be a part-time artist and socialite, of course, says Vogue. If you're looking for a man in finance, the queue's over there.
That was Lara Prendergast. Next, Penn Vogler.
In Food for Life, Tim Spector's book on the science of eating, the author gives the chemical makeup of a mystery food, listing more than 30 scary-sounding E numbers, sugars, acids and chemicals, before revealing that it is an apple. Sally Coulthard's book shows that it's the apple's complexity as well as its familiarity that makes it the ideal punchline for Spector, and for Coulthard a perfect vehicle to carry the history of how we grow, trade, cook and eat together and take responsibility for each other and the environment, or not. What we think of as an apple today, the sweet Japanese Fuji, the American picture book Red Delicious, or the sharper British-friendly Cox or Bramley, owes its gamut of qualities to an easygoing readiness to adapt to local conditions. Coulthard's story begins with the ancient ancestor of the Gala and Granny Smith, which hitchhiked west from the wild apple forests of the Kazakhstan mountains, promiscuously mixing with local crab apples along the way. The resulting hybrids produce fruit with qualities we still appreciate: sweetness and acidity, texture, disease resistance and storability, unsweetened lives and flavoured cultures as they travelled. Greeks, Romans, Norse and Celts rooted their fertility myths in the apple's embrace. Milton retrofitted the apple to the Bible's generic fruit of the tree of knowledge, making the most of the Latin malus for apple and evil. The apple is core to our history. I make no promises the puns will stop there, because as Coulthard shows in this crisp and refreshing account, apples and humans have been through so much together, it's natural they should share a language too. They crop up in surprising linguistic byways. Avalon is the island of apple trees. The old-fashioned hair grease, pomade, was made from the pulp of apples. Costermongers sold costards, which pop up in Edward I's fruit bowl. Coulthard appreciates the pun ability. I enjoyed insider trading, as the title of a chapter on the hard stuff. She has a taste too for juicy and gently myth-busting stories. William Tell's arrow-pierced apple originated not in Switzerland, but in Persia. Even before James Lind discovered that lime juice cured scurvy, Basque sailors held the disease at bay with unpasteurized cider. Heat kills vitamin C. The American nurseryman Johnny Appleseed planted trees he grew from seed as part of a land grab because his Swedenborgian beliefs outlawed grafting. The seeds produce spitters, too sour for eating and, ironically, only good for making the ferociously alcoholic Applejack, which sat badly with his religion's teetotalism. It's an easy book to chomp through, thanks to the cheerful prose and a structure that fruitfully grasps themes onto chronology. The taste and feel of the subject comes closest in the generous sprinkling of recipes from well-loved sources. Dried apples from the Elizabethan writer on agriculture, Hugh Platt. Apple turnovers from the first American best-selling cookery writer, Eliza Smith. For all our contemporary obsession with recipe twists and innovations, oddly conservative with the apple in the kitchen. We've lost the knack of reducing apples down to the intense spread, Jane Austen newest black butter, or bringing a dash of sour with verjuice from crab apples, or floating lamb's wool, fluffy roasted apple pulp on a bowl of steaming wassail. Give me a Norfolk biffin over chocolate at Christmas any time. The great compactness of their juicy persons can almost be felt on the tongue, thanks to this nicely chosen quote from A Christmas Carol. Britain reached a pitch of apple obsession when imported fruit from colonies past and present began pouring into our hungry markets. And Gladstone, galvanised by the threat, successfully inspired generations of orchard planters. However, in the century since, we've done badly in pomology, and the global growth of apple growing has an increasingly bitter taste, which Coulthard runs through in her final chapter, Crunch Time. Economic demands for monocultures, grubbing up ancient orchards for reliable, homogeneous fruit zapped with pesticides and herbicides, is not serving either the natural world of the orchard or our food security well. China now outproduces the US by a factor of eight by massively overusing pesticides. Meanwhile, Britain exports pesticides to low and middle-income countries containing not just chemicals which are banned in Europe. Coulthard came to the subject because she lives in a Yorkshire farmhouse where, in the 1840s, a young vicar set about planting an orchard which has survived to this day. I found myself wanting to know more about that rare orchard, its moss and blossom, the tang of its fruit. But although the sensory experience of growing and eating is a little elusive, Coulthard is cheerful and informative company on every leaf of this charming book.
That was Penvogler. Finally, James Dellingpole.
My resolution this summer was to see how far into the Olympics I could get without watching an event. It's harder than you think, especially when you've got kids calling constantly from the sitting room, "Dad, Dad, it's Romania versus Burkina Faso in the finals of the women's beach volleyball, and there's been a tremendous upset." I jest. Actually, I do know what happened in the finals of the women's beach volleyball. It was the first thing I watched because that was what was on when I walked into the room and broke my duck. Italy beat the long-standing champions, the United States, which delighted me enormously. One of the things that most annoyed me about the Olympics when I wasn't watching was hearing the American national anthem on auto-repeat from the TV room as they won yet another gold. Later, I got briefly very excited that a nice English woman I had never heard of before, and whose name I have since forgotten, won the 800 metres in spectacular fashion. I also got mildly diverted by the Team GB girl, Andrea Spendolini Syriex, who, after a few shaky attempts, got beaten to the medals by the near-perfect scoring Chinese in the diving, mainly because her dad is the French bloke who presents First Dates on Channel 4. And that's it. That's all I saw. Did quite well, didn't I? The Olympics are presumably a good time for all the networks to bury bad TV. Maybe that's why Netflix chose to release Joe Rogan's alleged comedy special right in the middle. Rogan is a former US sports commentator, mixed martial arts, who has somehow managed to parlay his minor celebrity and blandly amiable jockishness into a multi-gazillion dollar career as the world's biggest podcaster. But labelling him a stand-up comedian, I would suggest, is an implausibility too far. Rogan is marketed as a kind of edgy alternative to the mainstream media. In reality, he is about as edgy as Banksy. Explanation for American readers, not very. But he does his best. For example, when he had Elon Musk on one of his interminable podcasts, his longest podcast lasted 5 hours and 19 minutes, by the way, they famously shared a joint. "I mean, it's legal, right?" said Musk as he took the proffered reefer. And there's your problem right there. Yes, maybe back in the Ronald Reagan 1980s when, if it was your third offence, it could have landed you an automatic 25-year prison sentence, that would indeed have been pretty risque. But in 2024, you must be kidding. Marijuana smoking is so ubiquitous in most US states, and indeed right across the world, that it's almost compulsory. The really out there thing for Rogan to be doing nowadays would be to push out the old just say no mantra. Still, he knows how to please a crowd. The first part of his comedy set from the Majestic Theatre in San Antonio was dedicated to how amazingly blessed he felt to live in Texas, how Texans were truly the most wonderful people in the world, and none more wonderful than the ones who'd paid, or perhaps been paid, who knows, to see Joe Rogan live at the Majestic Theatre, San Antonio. This went down well. After that, he could have read extracts from the big bumper compendium of old jokes and still have been treated like the world's funniest man. Indeed, that was pretty much what he did. 1 minute he was riffing on the subject of aliens and their apparent fascination with intimate personal investigations on humans, which South Park dealt with in 1997 in its very first episode, titled Cartman Gets an Anal Probe. The next, he was recycling an old Joan Rivers gag about Michelle Obama, and then swiftly retracting it in case, heaven forfend, anyone thought he was being serious. Stick to the podcast, Joe. For times like these, telly is always thin in August. What you really need is Mubi, M-U-B-I. This is a subscription channel which gives you access to films you're unlikely to find anywhere else. All those brilliant, usually foreign, elliptical, dreamy, thought-provoking art house films which you would have gone to see at the cinema if only you'd realised before it was too late that they were being shown. We've watched some crackers in the last few months. Claire Denis' Beau Travail, that's Billy Budd transported to the French Foreign Legion in 1990s Djibouti. Agnès Varda's 1962 classic Cléo from 5 to 7, in which you get to see Paris as you would like it still to be. Wim Wenders' Perfect Days, more involving than a movie about a Tokyo public toilet cleaner has any right to be. And most recently, Alice Rohrwacher's mesmerising La Chimera, about a moody Englishman expatriate in 1980s Tuscany who scrapes his artfully dishevelled living plundering Etruscan tombs. You can be sure Joe Rogan won't have watched any of them.
Before we go, Coffeehouse Shots Live is returning in September. Join Fraser Nelson, Katie Balls, Kate Andrews and a very special guest as they discuss Labour's plans for when Parliament returns and ahead of the autumn budget. The event is taking place on Wednesday the 4th of September at 6:30 p.m. here in Westminster. For tickets, head to spectator.co.uk/live. And that's everything for this week. For more articles, pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine or check out our website. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please do give us a follow to make sure you never miss an episode. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.